Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. Repeat guest on today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on, and hello, everyone. My name's Greg Lawton, and I'm here to speak to you about my personal views on dispensing errors and decriminalisation.
Very good. Morning, Greg. I think you've been on once before, at least, I think, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Very
Thanks
good.
for having me again.
Big listenership every time you're on, so hence you keep getting the call. So that's not that I'm cynical
pressure.
At all.
Okay.
let's get straight into it then. Decriminalisation and all that malarkey that's been rolling on for quite a few months, years, decades. Not quite decades, but getting on that way.
Yeah.
So what's the worst dispensing error you've ever made?
Well, that's a good one. I think probably my first one, actually, because I was working in a boot store at the time, just after I'd qualified, and I remember it because I was working on my own, and I probably didn't think too much about it at that time, to be honest, being newly qualified. But I made a dispensing error, probably a fairly straightforward one, a Symbicort turbohaler, and I gave out the wrong strength, and I actually made the same error on two separate occasions. Swapped the strength, and the second time I was really sort of kicking myself that I'd done it again, and drove out to the patient's house and met them just as they were getting home and recovered it before they'd used it, and apologized profusely. But I guess it's quite scary when you do that, and fortunately I'd identify that one myself, but that doesn't always happen. Sometimes it can go out, and you're reliant on the patient picking up on it, or the patient's representative, and it's a bit down to, for want of a better word, luck as to as to what happens once it's left the pharmacy.
Absolutely, we've all been there, and I think I've said this before on the podcast. It's pharmacist I used to work with, who was very experienced, used to say it's the errors you don't know about that you need to worry about, which was really reassuring to me. Not
exactly. I mean, I think probably luck doesn't do it justice. It's there are various circumstances, obviously, as to how these things get picked up. But I understand that worry.
I can't remember my first one, but like everyone, I've made dispensing errors. I remember one of the companies I worked for, I think we rearranged the dispensary, so it was I don't know, A to Z by proprietary brand, and then we made it all generic, and the error rate increased, or the near miss rate increased after that. And I thought, goodness me, it's just a thought, isn't it? And as you say, your brain can play funny tricks on you when you focus on it and think too much about it. So do you think overall there's too many dispensing errors?
That's a really interesting question. There's a school of thought that says that one dispensing error is too many. Where we are in pharmacy, the last line of defense quite often to prevent errors from reaching a patient, because there's quite a lot of errors that happen on GP prescriptions, affecting 1 in 8 patients in all told, and that's not just incorrectly written prescription items. That includes other errors as well. But pharmacy is the line of defence there before it actually reaches a patient. But it's complicated, because we are human. We are going to make mistakes, and that's true of everyone. So trying to eliminate that entirely would be an incredible feat, and perhaps it would be impossible. But it would be it'd be great to reduce the number, and I think there are certain things that we could do to reduce the number of dispensing errors. Sure.
Yeah, I think, and to be fair to some of the the people I've worked with, I mean, I've worked for Boots as well, and they were, gotta admit, they were really hot on doing what we could as a team to sort of, you know, pick up, record near misses and so on and so forth. One of the things I don't know if my ex-clinical, you probably know her actually, my ex-clinical governance pharmacist and I discussed towards the end of my tenure there was an electronic near miss system, and I think the MPA have taken something similar forward. And I guess for me it's all about data and trying to paint that picture of what's actually happening. And then of course the killer thing is, it's a bad turn of phrase in this conversation perhaps, but the important thing is making sure that people are, or pharmacists are, happy to report errors and understanding why perhaps they say they are, but in reality we know that perhaps all the errors aren't being reported. What sanction would I face if someone made a complaint and took me all the way to court at the moment?
Okay, I mean, in terms of criminal law, I mean, fortunately, the actual number of prosecutions for inadvertent dispensing errors is fairly low. I mean, it doesn't happen that often, fortunately. However, that is not really the issue, because it's the prospect of a prosecution happening and the prospect of a sanction that creates the patient safety issue, because it can create the fear of reporting a dispensing error. Now, ordinarily in law, people have a right against self-incrimination, so they're not obliged to give anything over in evidence that would incriminate themselves. It's arguable as to whether that applies in healthcare, because we do have duties to report dispensing errors, but pharmacies in the UK is in quite an unusual situation in that pretty much any dispensing error is a criminal offence. So if someone is requiring you to record a dispensing error, as we should as pharmacists, you're actually recording information which could be used against you in court in the future in a prosecution, which, you know, in a case which could affect your liberty. I mean, dispensing errors can carry prison sentences, typically up to 2 years in prison for most medicines, and in theory it can be life imprisonment for certain controlled drugs. So I think in terms of the current legal situation, I'd absolutely advocate that people do record dispensing errors, but that's not really an acceptable position to be in when they face the risk of prosecution and sanction. So in terms of the areas of law, various areas of law under which someone can be prosecuted, under the Human Medicines Regulations, the Misuse of Drugs Act, and under the Medicines Act. So last year, as a result of the work of the Rebalancing Board in April 2018, some conditional defences were introduced to two areas of the Medicines Act, Section 63 and 64. So if someone is prosecuted under those areas of medicines law, they have potentially some defences available, but they need not be prosecuted under those areas of law. There are other areas of law where you can just avoid those defences altogether. Now, underneath that, there's another level of detail, which is that in other areas of medicines law under which pharmacists can face prosecution and sanction, some may apply to all pharmacists and others could be argued to apply only to pharmacy owners. But that would have to be decided by a court as and when the point arises. It would depend on the nature of the dispensing error as to which laws apply, but ultimately the threat of prosecution and sanction still remains whilst the law is as it is. So it's a bit pointless, really, the defences just to those two areas of the Medicines Act, and they're so complicated, convoluted and conditional that you really wonder why they bothered with them at all. And so, yeah, pharmacists can still be prosecuted and can face criminal sanction for inadvertent dispensing errors.
As you say, it's that impact on how that potential prosecution makes the pharmacist feel. I mean, it's going to, I mean, the conclusion that many will draw, although it's very hard to prove, is that reporting may well be altered and suppressed, unlike in other industries like the airline industry, for example, where open reporting is very widely accepted.
Yeah.
And of course, if we underreport, then, you know, that again, another assumption and conclusion that I would draw is that we don't know the number and nature of the errors that are happening, and therefore obviously it's more difficult to improve things, isn't it?
Yes.
One of the things that used to make me nervous in a number of the companies that I used to work for, in the various roles that I did, were the zero reporting stores.
Yeah.
So there were, you'll be familiar with this, there were stores that, you know, claimed by their inactivity on the error reporting system that they had no dispensing errors for like 2 years or something. You know,
yeah,
highly, highly unlikely, unless they were hiding a robot somewhere in the dispensary, you know.
Yeah.
So do you think, on that note, do you think there's underreporting generally?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the role that I used to work in, I think some of the best area managers that I had that were most positive about patient safety and really encouraged reporting had double the number of incident reports compared to other area managers. And, you know, I think pharmacists will set out with the best intentions of reporting dispensing errors, but I think there are various reasons why we see underreporting, and you know, the prospect of criminal sanctions being one of those. And that, you know, that's just not just me saying that. I think that's quite widely recognised. That's you know, part of different Department of Health policy, and that's, you know, they recognise that the prospect of criminal sanctions can lead to underreporting. But I actually think that one of the main reasons for underreporting, and perhaps the main reason, is the pressure that people experience in community pharmacy. It's simply not having the time to report.
Good point. I find that as well. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and that's also backed up by a survey that Pharmacy Voice did a few years ago. They asked people what would be the reasons why you'd find it most difficult to report. I can't remember exactly how the question was phrased, but the top one was time constraints. So I think it's just the time it's not just a reporting of them either. It's properly investigating them, understanding why it's happened, and then taking steps to learn from it and trying to reduce the risk of it happening again. That's the important bit, and all of that takes time. So you know, when you've got the number of dispensing errors that are happening so let's just take NHS England, for example. They dispense a billion prescription items a year. And the study that probably the most, the best quality study on it, that's cited the most often, is James et al. And the dispensing error rate within that is quite a large variance, to be honest, in the error rate. It goes from 0.04%, I think it is, up to 3.32%. So at the top end of that, if you had 3.32% of a billion prescription items, you're talking about 33 million prescription items having a dispensing error associated with them. Now, that depends on how you define a dispensing error as well. So if you define a dispensing error as the wrong strength, the wrong dose, the wrong drug, then that's one definition. But if you capture other things on there, like, for example, you've misspelled the patient's name, or you've missed the fact that the medicine shouldn't be dispensed to somebody under under the age of 12, for example, then, you know, that sort of gives you a broader definition of a dispensing error, and then you know your percentages will increase. But yeah, I think you know there's absolutely underreporting for various reasons. But if you had that many dispensing errors happening, even at 0.04%, it still takes quite a bit of time up to report those and investigate them thoroughly.
Yeah, a couple of things on that. I would be skeptical. I've read that paper recently, and I would be skeptical about that upper number, to be honest. I would still be cautious about that. I suspect the rate could in some cases be higher, actually. But anyway, that's up for debate another day. The broad thing for me, or the broad issue around reporting of dispensing errors in general, is that, and I pull it back again to the aviation industry that I find quite interesting in this discussion. So, you know, I think it was the Tenerife accident, 1979, perhaps, when basically one aeroplane was taking off, or set to take off, and another one was landing, and there was something in the wording of, you know, carry on, that was misconstrued by the plane on the ground, and actually the instruction was supposed to be wait. Anyway, the plane pulled forward and the landing plane crashed into them, leading to disaster, of course. And the details of that aren't overly important, except the fact that incident had ramifications for how every single air traffic controller spoke to planes on the ground from then on. And that stands today. I wish I could remember the wording. I'll look it up and maybe put it in the show notes, but you get the gist. And my point is that you're right, the important bit, reporting it, errors in pharmacy is just one aspect of it. Like, the real value comes in making sure you analyze it and understand what happened and make sure it doesn't happen again. And I totally agree, Greg. I am not convinced that enough time, effort, or resource is put into understanding why things happen. And also, if an error happens, you know, if my Tenerife incident, the pharmacy equivalent, happens in Aberdeen, will those learnings be shared with, you know, a little independent pharmacy in Portsmouth?
Yeah,
I would say the answer to that is no. And I think we as a profession take a heavy responsibility for that. We need to fix that.
It's a really good point. I think, you know, there's so much more that we could do to share those kind of learnings and do that openly. And if that was, you know, if that was done, then that, you know, that could really help. But I think also there's also a bit about, I think, being honest about what the real causes are behind dispensing errors, and not just looking at the superficial things. I think that would be a big step, and I think I think companies find that very difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is the whole point of this conversation, isn't it? You know, now we're just about to move on to the politics of this, of decriminalisation, and there's something holding things back here. I mean, the narrative around all of this, I feel, is, you know, the weight of responsibility sits once again on the individual pharmacist. You know, we've got a gun to our head, as it were, in terms of these dispensing errors. Whereas the narrative should be from our leadership. It should be, look, report errors to save lives, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what is criminal, in my view, is, or potentially criminal, is, you know, having to make the same error multiple times for things to change. That would keep me up at night. Anyway, I digress and I start to rant. Before we get on to the politics of it, what level of human error in dispensing do you think is acceptable?
I'm not sure it's possible to give a figure. I mean, for a single activity, a really simple activity, people work to about 93% accuracy. But you know, the figures get more complicated when you start looking at complex tasks and you know, where there are multiple opportunities to identify an error. So it's I don't think it's really possible to say what level is acceptable. I think the focus always needs to be on trying to reduce whatever level of error that we have, so that, you know, whatever is the current status quo, doing what we can to reduce the risk of error, and you know, and therefore reduce the risk to patients.
Perfect. So now to the tricky bit, politics. As you know, I had a foray into pharmacy politics, the Scottish Pharmacy Board. I struggle with it. Diplomacy doesn't come easily. I think you also need a large degree of patience to be in politics as well. And perhaps I'm too impatient. Anyway, in 2017, Andrew Evans, Chief Pharmaceutical Officer for Wales, said at an RPS conference, to quote, that decriminalising errors, I assume he means dispensing errors, would make patient safety better.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, that's quite widely recognised. I think the Department of Health has recognised that, and I think it's quite widely accepted in pharmacy. You know, I think we'll get on to the politics, but I think
at the risk of this sounding like a courtroom, I think it's important to validate and establish that core assumption before we move forward into the discussion about politics. Because if we assume that decriminalisation will improve patient safety, then there's a massive question mark as to why it hasn't happened yet. So on one hand, carry on.
I was just going to say, probably it's worth sort of covering the rationale behind that as well. And I think the reason that it would make patients safer, in my view, is that if you take away that fear of criminal prosecution and criminal sanction, then you can encourage pharmacists. You're in the right platform then to encourage pharmacists to report dispensing errors. And you know, if you're doing that, then you're not asking them to put their personal liberty at risk. And also, then they wouldn't have that fear of reporting dispensing errors. So you know, you should then expect to see an increase in reporting, an increase in the analysis and investigation of dispensing errors, and better learning coming from that, and then ultimately at the end of it, patients should be better protected. And I appreciate there are other, you know, there are other factors that affect, as we've discussed, what, you know, how easy it is for pharmacists to report. But that's the, you know, that's the rationale, and I think it's probably fair to say that that's the acceptable rationale within the profession as to why it wouldn't make things safer.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, that's an important basis with which to move this conversation forward. So on one hand, two things to sort of say next. Then, you know, on one hand, talk me through the sort of potted history of the politics of this decriminalisation adventure so far. But also, whilst doing that, tell me who is sabotaging it, and why has it not happened yet?
So one of the earliest cases was RPSGB in Storkwain, in which a pharmacist was convicted under Section 58 of the Medicines Act for supplying against a fraudulent prescription. Unwittingly, they hadn't intended to do it. And there was an attempt to use a defence from another section of the Medicines Act, but that could not be, you know, that couldn't be read in. From a different section, so they tried to read in that there was a requirement for the pharmacist to have a guilty mindset into Section 58, and that couldn't, you know, that wasn't possible because it just didn't apply to that particular section of law. So that, you know, that conviction stood. Then, you know, so the peppermint water case in 1998, in which a pharmacist and a pre-reg were charged with manslaughter, which was then dropped on the day of the hearing and substituted for a conviction under Section 64 of the Medicines Act. Then there was the Elizabeth Lee case in 2007. I mean, there are various other sort of in between. I'm just covering some of the big ones. But I think it's probably in 2007 when the effort to remove the threat of criminal sanction for inadvertent dispensing errors really got underway. And, you know, because of the high profile nature of that particular case, that got the support of the profession. January 2013, the rebalancing board was set up, and that their role included to deliver the Department of Health's stated policy objective, which was to remove the threat of criminal sanction for inadvertent preparation and dispensing errors. That was part of its role. Whilst they were engaged in their work in December 2016, Martin White, a pharmacist in Northern Ireland, was given a 4-month suspended prison sentence for an error. And then in April 2018, there were some conditional defences, as I mentioned earlier, to Section 63 and 64 of the Medicines Act were introduced. So that's, you know, there are various other sort of examples of criminal prosecutions over time, but that's sort of a rough history of it. I think one of the real difficulties that we've got at the moment is that, you know, back in 2007, there was support from the government to remove the threat of criminal sanction, and that's a real difficulty. And actually, it puts us back in time to before 2007. We've got more work to do than we had then, because whilst in 2007 we had the government's support to address this issue, the profession currently doesn't have that support because the government's saying that they've done it. And that's, you know, that's, as I said, that's not the case. The PDA took some advice, got some legal advice from a QC, a barrister, and then had that subsequently confirmed by a leading pharmacy lawyer, a partner in a solicitor's firm. And essentially, there are various issues. One is that the defences that under Section 63 and 64 are full of holes. So there are various ways that those defences can be defeated. And two is that even if you didn't want to use those defences, you can prosecute someone under a different area of medicines law entirely and just avoid the need for the defences altogether. So the risk of the prospect of criminal sanction is very much still there. Now, it hasn't been helped by, I think, in terms of the politics, an interesting starting point is to consider some of the statements that have been made. So 9th of April 2018, Ken Jarrell, the chairman of the rebalancing board, said, and I'm quoting directly, "These new defences, combined with the existing defences in the Medicines Act, will encourage the reporting of errors without fear of prosecution. This is a great success for the board." And the rebalancing board as an entity, in its official statement, said on the 9th of April again, in a question and answer document, "Unlike other health professionals, pharmacy professionals are currently at risk of criminal prosecution when inadvertent human error happens in the course of their routine professional practice. This order aligns registered pharmacy professionals who are working in registered pharmacies with other health professions in this regard. It supports increased reporting of errors without fear of prosecution." So, another example, actually, a member of the rebalancing board said that it was one of the key achievements of his career. He was asked what things he most proud of, and the quote was, "One is getting inadvertent dispensing errors legislation through and seeing it hit the statute book, and seeing the protection and removal of the threat of criminal sanctions against pharmacists in a community setting." And this, the particular member of the rebalancing board, I actually had a discussion with on social media back in 2018, and I pointed to an article by a leading pharmacy lawyer that gave the opinion that the defences are all a bit pointless. and you know, explained that people could be prosecuted still under those sections of the Medicines Act and under other areas. And then you know, another pharmacist asked him about it, and his response was that any attempt to suggest that the change doesn't remove the threat of criminal prosecution is incorrect. So I suppose, you know, in terms of the politics, an interesting starting point is to think to yourself, okay, well, let's assume that the rebalancing board is competent, okay? And I think, you know, it's a fair assumption to assume that the board is competent because, you know, they've had consultations on this issue. They've got access to government lawyers. The members of the rebalancing board individually have got access to, you know, access to their own lawyers. And, you know, there's nothing to stop any lawyer just having a look at the medicines legislation and identifying these issues that have talked about under which people can be prosecuted. You've got really senior people from the profession sat on the rebalancing board. You've got the chief pharmaceutical officers, you've got the GPHC, PSNI, the RPS, various representatives of pharmacy owners. Actually, the NPA and the PDA aren't on that represented on the board, but you know. So
why was that? Why were they not included?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, the two organisations with the greatest legal expertise and probably with the, you know, who would have offered the challenge, aren't on the board, and you know, you can probably draw your own conclusions about why that might be the case. But
and what stage is it at the moment? So in summary, Greg, nothing, you know. I'm trying to understand this. It is a bit of a bizarre situation, it would appear. So legally, nothing really has changed. Is that right?
Well, legally, there have been changes. Yeah, the defences to Section 63 and 64 are there. They will apply in certain cases, but not in others. So just to give you an example of that, the defences have certain requirements which have to be met in order for the defence to apply, and I won't go into detail about what those are because, you know, that would probably not be responsible of me to do that because it's quite detailed and it needs to be specific. But then on top of the, you know, the mandatory requirements for the defence to apply, then you've got to meet either condition A or condition B, which is two further sets of requirements. So condition A will fail, for example, if the pharmacist knew of the error before being charged by the police. So if you think about what happens in a normal dispensing error, you know, you might identify it yourself as I said that I did in the dispensing error that I made, or a patient might just bring it to your attention, or the patient's representative. And in that case, you knew of the error before being charged, so you can't rely on that part of the defence anymore, unless your knowledge was acquired only as a result of an investigation into whether an offence was committed. And in that case, you know, I think it's pretty clear that wouldn't be part of an investigation. If the patient just comes up and tells you that, you know, I've got this error, that's not part of an investigation into whether it's an offence has been committed. That's just, you know, that's just the patient telling you categorically that it has. So it's really bizarre, and I'm not sure why they've developed these really complicated defences. We would like to see ideally the removal of the criminal offence altogether, but that would, you know, that would require quite a significant rework of primary legislation. But another alternative to that would be to provide a much broader defence, which said that for the error to still be a criminal offence, the prosecution would have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that it was not inadvertent. So they would have to prove that it was, you know, it was a deliberate act. And, you know, obviously the law should still continue to apply to deliberate acts. And there are other areas of law, even if you made that change, other areas of law which would still apply. So prosecution for gross negligence, manslaughter potentially won't, you know, would be unaffected by those changes. Also, there are prosecutions that could be brought for crimes against the person, but that's, you know, that applies to every, you know, every health profession. That you know, that would be the same for doctors, the same for dentists and nurses and so on. What's different in pharmacy is that as part of your routine work, you can be prosecuted for you know, a simple human error. And that's, you know, that's what we need to change.
Okay. And do you think, you know, how close are we to a solution to this?
Well, I think that these statements that have been made, I mean, they've not been retracted. You know, they're still the existing positions of the rebalancing board, for example. These positions still stand. So I think we're further back than we were back in 2007 because, you know, as I say, we've not got the support of the government. And ultimately, you've got to get to a place where you overcome this this stance, this pretense that, you know, that it's been fixed. And then once you've overcome that, you still have to get on and fix it. So, you know, we're quite some way. It's quite some way away. And as I say, further in a worse position than we were prior to Elizabeth Lee, I think.
And so you actually think we're farther behind the curve now than we were before Elizabeth made that error?
Yes.
Goodness me.
Yeah. In terms of actually getting a solution to it, which will make a difference, yes. I mean, we have got the defences there, you know. That's not to you know, that's one thing. But you know, we, in terms of actually solving this thing, then I think, yeah, we're further behind.
And how do we do that? You know, how do we make that happen? We're in the kind of era of referendums and petitions. And I mean, one petition recently that came to mind was on the pharmacy apprenticeship proposals. And of course that it didn't quite go viral, but within the niche of pharmacy it certainly did. So yeah. You know, is there something about articulating this and putting it to the people, as it were, or have you any ideas on how to move it forward? Because you clearly feel that the rebalancing board, would it be fair to say, isn't fit for purpose, should be dissolved, and an overarching review of the law in this area should be conducted?
I think an overarching review of the law is needed for sure. I don't think that the rebalancing board hasn't delivered that Department of Health objective that I mentioned earlier on. So either, you know, they need to look at that and consider it again. But you know, this has been pointed out to them on several occasions. So you know, it's very difficult to say, you know, how you work around that. I think that all that organisations can do is inform pharmacists of the reality of the situation. But some organisations are still in the place of claiming that the issue has been resolved, but that's not the case. It would help, I think, if those organisations retracted the previous statements, and it would help if they talked to their own members about the fact that the issue is still there. But it's going to be embarrassing, I'm afraid, for some of them, because they've gone down this route seemingly without checking or getting their own legal advice on it, which I'm pretty sure would be the same as that the PDA announced it had obtained when it had its national conference in March earlier this year.
And what message do you think all this sends to, you know, well, sends to me when I go and do my odd locum in community pharmacy? Do you think, I mean, what impact, what influence do you think the fact that the inadvertent dispensing errors are basically still an issue, what influence will that have on reporting levels and for patient safety?
Well, I think it has an impact on reporting levels. I think it will probably also have an impact on what confidence pharmacists can have in you know, in the organisations that have given the impression that that the issue has been resolved when it hasn't. In terms of the impact on reporting levels, if someone is now reporting because they think that they think that that risk of criminal prosecution and sanction is gone, then that would clearly suppress it again. I guess if that was if that's the reason that person has for deciding to report or not. So it's not a great situation, but that is where we are, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. It's been, as ever, Greg, it's been really interesting talking to you. Huge respect for the way you've laid out your view and your document. I would direct listeners to your LinkedIn account, actually. I think you've got an article published there, haven't you, on this very topic. So you published that in 2018, isn't that right?
Yeah, that was just something I'd written in my own time on in a personal capacity. So welcome people to have a look at that and criticise it or comment on it, whatever. So I just find it an interesting topic, and I felt it was important to document the process so far, because it's been such a protracted one. You know, even from Elizabeth Lee, we're 12 years down the line from that, and still the issue is there. So
these sagas that drag on, especially political sagas, it like a complicated mathematical sum, it is often very useful to simply state the facts and in mathematical terms show you're working, because where we've got to makes much more sense when that's the case. And I think you've probably done the profession a service in doing that in this case. And my commitment to you, I guess, is and others who are concerned about inadvertent dispensing errors is to approach some of the rebalancing board, get them on, and Twitter, and so I've said it widely before, Twitter and social media is interesting and useful and a bit of fun, but it's also quite binary when you're discussing more complicated topics like this. So I do think the podcast format might be quite interesting to get some of the members of the Rebalancing Board on, and if they were willing, and have a good old conversation about it, as we've done with you. I mean, you're clearly one side of the view. It would be right and proper that we see some opposing or hear some opposing views, and there must be opposing views, because otherwise it would have happened.
Yeah, sure.
There's it's been great to talk to you, Greg. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Jonathan. Really appreciate it.
I'll speak to you soon. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye.